It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we're going to talk about how the cowbell went from a farmer's tool to a musical and cultural sensation.
But first, we're talking about a new report from the Wisconsin Center for Nursing. The report projects a shortage of 20,000 nurses by the year 2035. Here to explain why the shortage might be happening and to talk about what we can do about it is Judith Hansen. She's Executive Director for the Wisconsin Center for Nursing. Judith, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica. I'm just delighted to be here. Thank you.
Well, a shortage of 20,000 nurses is what you're projecting. It's a big number. How did you get there?
Well, that's a good question. We have tremendous data in Wisconsin because every 2 years we have mandated surveys for both our RNs and our LPNs. And we also, in the formation of our report, were able to look at a number of different nursing workforce reports. And so between the data that WCN had received and also other reports, we were able to do a large compilation of this to make some very, very reliable and interesting statistics. Along with that, we have also relied heavily on some very sophisticated forecasting tools that have been developed by the Office of Economic Advisors from the Department of Workforce Development. And all of these work together to bring us to the numbers that we're going to be talking about today.
Now, 2035, it's a ways off, so we maybe have time to redirect this, but what is the primary factor in driving the shortage of nurses?
Right now, I would say it's kind of a coming together of what I would call a perfect storm in terms of what we're facing in the future, and it's resulting in, as you mentioned, some very staggering numbers. A lot of this is coming as a result and stems from the baby boomer generation getting close to retirement. We have, first of all, that, some very rapidly changing demographics in our state. And with that, people are living longer. And, of course, then often comes the more demand for health care, the highest utilization of health care, and the most costly, I would add, is in the latter stages of life. And so if we put that in actual numbers, we're actually looking at 100% increase in people over 65 by that year to 2035. And with those over 85, it's even larger. So we've got that whole population demographic going on around us. And then along with that, we as nurses are an aging nursing workforce. Not only our RNs, we're about average age of 48. LPNs is a little older, 50. And, of course, we know that LPNs are the primary workforce in our nursing homes and extended care settings. And our data is telling us that the economic recession has kept people our age in the workforce longer than we expected to be. And so we're looking at this surge of retirement, probably up to 60% in the next 10 years of our workforce. And so those two factors in combination are what's driving this concern. The third element of that, the third leg of the stool, as I would call it, is that we also have that same age composition, in fact, older, in our faculty, our nursing educators. Their average age with a doctorate degree is about 58. And so we're looking at another surge of retirement, in fact, in less time. A third of them plan to retire in 4 years or less. So all those things in the mix are creating this large concern, really, for a massive exodus of our workforce.
I see what you mean about the perfect storm there. So then I guess the question is, like, let's say nothing changes and we do see that projected 20,000 nursing job shortfall. What is health care going to look like in Wisconsin?
That is a great question. And you know, nobody has the crystal ball that's going to answer all these things. But we do know that data does represent sound knowledge for us to approach these problems. And I think that is a great strength that Wisconsin has going for it. A lot of states don't have the benefit of getting the data like we do, so that is really a positive in our favor. But I think that down the road, we need to look at what we want to prepare in terms of our workforce, the level of nursing, and also, you know, where they end up working. As healthcare transforms, we know there are going to be huge opportunities for nursing in different roles to help transform that care. And we know that is right around the corner. We expect to see a greater shift in community-based care, emphasis towards prevention and population health. And nurses have huge skill sets that could be very, very beneficial for cost-effective and high-quality care in these areas. And I could also add that, you know, it's just not nursing that is facing these shortages. Other healthcare professions are looking at the same thing. And so we really need to be looking at the healthcare team, the interprofessional team, and the roles that we can all play to make the biggest contribution to these needs.
So obviously identifying this projected shortfall is part of the equation here, but what have you got planned to try to make sure that this doesn't happen, doesn't come to pass the way we're thinking it might?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think we need to acknowledge that the big question I get asked is, are there shortages right now? And the answer to that is yes, in some places. We are already realizing nursing shortages in areas of the state where perhaps the younger generation nurse does not want to go. They tend to want jobs in the urban areas where life is a little more exciting, perhaps. I don't know. But the rural areas are already seeing shortages in some specialties. And so we don't want to take our foot off the gas now in terms of saying there is no shortage just because the vacancy rates aren't there right now. So don't let people get that false sense of security. We do know that from the projections, like I said, this wave of retirements is coming. And I think the biggest thing is we need to look at some really high standards to continue to put out high quality, high numbers of graduates each year. Wisconsin programs do a great job at preparing nurses. Our nurses do very, very well on passing their NCLEX exams to become licensed nurses. And really, this is it's a huge economic driver in Wisconsin, because our data also tells us that 85% of the nurses educated here stay in Wisconsin to work. And so what we need to do is help nursing programs increase their capacity and prepare more faculty. And we get a little bit caught up in a catch-22 sometimes, because there are interested students out there. There's a lot of promising young students who want to be nurses, and there's also a lot of interest in nursing as a second career choice. But the problem is we have to reject applicants because we don't have the capacity to educate them. So I think that in Wisconsin we need to be looking at more funding, a lot of our funding for nursing education, and loan forgiveness, things like that, has gone away. We certainly need to get on a better pathway to make those things happen again. And I think there is a lot of opportunity. We all know we can't do anything alone anymore. We need collaborative partnerships, things like very creative thinking, like partnerships between health systems and schools, agreements to work in certain environments, you know, for loan forgiveness, for tuition reimbursement, helping nurses advance their education with seamless progression tracks between our two-year graduates and our baccalaureate-prepared nurses so that they can advance their educational levels.
And what about getting more men in on it, having more men as nurses?
That is another big focus area. We have a very small percentage of men in nursing and a very small percentage of minority nurses, so we need to do outreach for our diversity. We're working closely with minority nursing associations and also groups like the American Assembly of Men in Nursing to help bring that about. and showcasing nursing as a very, very strong, viable profession to have in the future.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Judith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Veronica.
We've been talking to Judith Hansen, Executive Director for the Wisconsin Center for Nursing.
Coming up next, I've got a fever, and the only cure is more cowbell. We'll find out how the cowbell became a cultural icon and a musical instrument. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time.
Now, a look at the humble cowbell. What started as a farmer's prop is now a legendary musical instrument. But how did we get there?
Lori Rotenberg joins us now. She's a writer and a journalist. Her piece, More Cowbell, From Herdsman's Tool to Cultural Icon, appeared on Modern Farmer. We've linked that, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page. Lori, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me today. Hello, Wisconsin.
Well, Wisconsin is interested in its cowbells. What do we know about the origin of the cowbell?
Well, it starts about 10,000 years ago and was definitely something herdsmen used. You know, what kind of animals, probably goats, sheep, lambs, or whatever, might have been around, you know, that long ago. And they started out being used with snail shells, then progressed to stone, wood, bronze, and, you know, metal, iron, things that we have today. You know, the four-sided cowbell, which is different than what they use in Europe, which is a rounded cowbell.
What was the purpose?
That would be the start.
What was the purpose of these original cowbells?
To keep track of animals, and you know, in more modern times, a lead cow, you know, their best cow or the one that would lead the herd out, would wear a larger bell. Perhaps a new calf would wear something smaller. So it was both a tool that the animals could listen to where each animal would be in a pasture or in a field, and as well the herdsmen could tell where they were, you know, especially at dusk and bringing them back down from a pasture.
You mentioned a rounded European cowbell. Why do we have a distinctly American one, and what's different?
In Europe, they're rounded, you know, and
more like a bell.
Why. I think it was more the style, you know, the style of it. It has a little bit more of a ring sound to it versus the ping that the American style has. And again, what I would suspect is the size of the pasture. And then towards the end of the story, it sort of tells you a little bit about, you know, I think it's the D model gives a deeper ring in the U.S. so you can hear it a little bit further. But it's just a style and how we design them. But in Europe, it's a little bit more of a ringing sound.
It seems like these days, if you're in a rock band, you're legally obligated to use a cowbell. How did it make the jump from just being this agricultural thing to being a musical instrument?
The way musicologists think it happened was it started with both Gustav Mahler and Richard Strauss, starting in the early 1900s, when both, at different times, wrote symphonic works. And it was very avant-garde at the time, but each used cowbells in pastoral movements to bring to mind to listeners, again, the peacefulness of the fields. And both men had grown up around agricultural areas, and Mahler in particular really held fast to that in his life, but they were very well aware of the cow parades and pasture. So they brought that in for, when they wrote symphonies that had to do with mountainsides, and in Mahler's symphony, specific in number 6, it has a lot. It's a very dark symphony that has a lot to do with a lot of things, but it was to bring that idea in of peacefulness in a pastoral sense. So they brought cowbells in to have the listeners feel that, and would use them during those movements. The percussionists would either, you know, jingle the bells, or in Mahler's case, at one point, I think in Vienna, he had the percussionist walk through the symphony, through the orchestra, and have it around his neck.
I'm sure he loved that.
Kind of like a roaming cow. And what happened?
Punishment for the bad percussionist.
Really, the kazoo was in his other pocket. But what happened subsequently was, you know, it became a percussionist tool, and to better control the ring, they removed the clapper, and you know, then hit it with likely a drumstick or some other thing they had.
Well, we have a sample of some of that early symphonic cowbell. Let's take a listen. I think this is the Mahler.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just kind of clanking around there in the background. Well, it made the jump into rock and roll. And we'll go to another clip right away. I think one of the ones you refer to. I think we have Grazing in the Grass.
Oh, sure.
Here it is.
Little clip of Grazing in the Grass there. It's funny with the Mahler, you kind of smell churned butter, but with this one, it's really made a jump. This is not, you know, your grandfather's cowbell there.
No, it's like, get your cow on. Don't you just picture somebody in a little cow suit wiggling, but yeah, it's very different, and the drummers, percussionists now use it in such a variety of ways that it's pretty amazing what they can do with one.
Well, interesting, a lot of times when I think of rock songs, I think of quarter notes, like clank, 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 clank. But that one was 16th notes. Decca, 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 decca. You don't hear quite that rapid-fire cowbell that often, I don't think.
It's not a precision instrument sometimes.
Yeah, I think Glenn Cochi said it, you know, it's a wonderful instrument of timing, you know, to keep time with and to create a rhythm. And he, of course, is the musician with Wilco, who is mentioned in the piece.
And then a Saturday Night Live spot really put the cowbell on the map, sometimes in an annoying way for people in bands. But let's give a listen. Christopher Walken in the famous Blue Oyster Cult cowbell skit.
Guess what? I got a fever. And the only prescription is more cowbell.
So that, I mean, that went viral. That was one of the early TV things to go viral in a way. And that's, so in a band, I think the phrase more cowbell being yelled out has replaced Freebird
sure.
From the audience. How did that capture people's imagination so much?
Yeah, the Saturday Night Live skit?
Mm-hmm.
I think probably because they were able to associate it with the music. I don't think they really ever thought about the drummer or a percussionist playing that. And, you know, it was always so hidden in the music that I don't think they even equated it with cowbell. You know, they made that distinction, the word, the vision of it. And I think it was the contrast of Will Ferrell's body and that bell that put the two things together. And from there on, I think people have been able to really hear the cowbell in a song, but also equate it with that video.
Does everybody like the cowbell, or is it a polarizing instrument, like, say, oh, I don't know, the saxophone?
Hey, what?
Rob plays the sax.
I think most people like it. I think they thought it might have been overwrought in the 70s and 80s music. You know, a lot of the hair bands used it, and it would always be a lot of the same lead-in that you'll hear in Def Leppard's Rock of Ages. You know, would
classic
kind of
song.
That. Yeah. Yeah, but I think in sports they maybe get tired of it, but I'm not so sure they do in music.
Well, it's still around. We pulled a clip from one of the summer's biggest hits, Blurred Lines by Robin Thicke. Here it is. All right. Now, I'll say I heard that song a zillion times, and you're right. Like, I didn't really think, oh, listen to that cowbell, but now that I'm looking for it, yeah, it's obvious. It's right there.
I think that cowbell sounds processed. That's why you didn't notice it. That cowbell has been through some stuff.
Well, everything's been through stuff these days.
Well, you know, they can sound that way. If you take a look on a drum kit, they come in different sizes, and they will have a clear sound like that without any reverberation almost. I don't even know what to say, but they can sound that clear. You know, it sounds to you probably very mechanical, but they can be that way.
It does. It sounds kind of synthed up to me.
Yeah, listen to it in Lay Lady Lay, in Bob Dylan's song, and you'll hear something very, very clear, very beautiful, by the way. It's just a mournful cowbell.
Well, is the cowbell still being used? Are there still cows trotting around with these bells on today?
Oh, absolutely. It's in Europe a lot, and mentioned in the piece is a place called the Bevan Bell Company in Connecticut that had a fire, I think, in May of 2012. And at the time that their plant burnt down, they still always made cowbells, but they were selling them again, sending them to a lot of younger farmers who wanted to farm in the 19th century way, more sustainable farmers. And they were, again, putting, you know, the bells on their cows. And you will find it in the heartland, in the Middle West. But what is also happening on larger farms is that they're using GPS to keep track of the cows and, you know, put chips in them to be able to locate them. So it's a little bit of both worlds, but there had been a nice movement back to it, and you will still see it, but you'll definitely see it in Europe a lot more than the United States.
Well, we'll watch for him. Lori, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Lori Rotenberg. She's a writer and author. We have a link to her piece, More Cowbell, on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, well, Halloween's right around the corner. We'll get some recommendations for some great scary books to get us in the mood.
And if the books aren't scary enough, how about some Wisconsin monsters? We'll learn about some mythical creatures in our state.
Coming up after the news, we'll look at the challenges couples face when they remarry and how to better navigate that process. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Hummingbird moths are fantastic imposters. Is it a moth or is it a bird?
Writer Jill Sisson-Quinn reflects on the moths flitting around her yard in this episode of Wisconsin Life.
Tonight, in a patch of bouncing bet, growing in a ditch on the roadside, I saw a peculiar sight. Amidst the stout leafy stems and the pink-white phlox-like flowers, a thick-bodied insect hovered, moving its wings like a hummingbird. In the blur of its flight, I could see two broad stripes, one yellow, one red. It moved from bloom to bloom, inserting a proboscis easily three times the length of its body, poking sometimes at blossoms still tightly balled. The proboscis was sometimes stick straight, sometimes perfectly curled, and sometimes bent at a near 90-degree angle. Then there was another, and another. I walked along the linear patch of bouncing bet, counting 17 on the way down and 17 on the way back. Surprised and satisfied with my data set, I leaned in to watch them. They seemed more inhabitants of than visitors to this modest flower patch. They never rested, bumping occasionally into my shins, then redirecting. I thought I could hear the faintest whir sometimes when they sped past. Not feathered, but furry, they became fuzzy in the dusk, ghost-like. A name came to mind, as it often does when I see something I have not seen before, a name that is never quite right, but right enough if all I want to do is stand there and look. This time I thought, hummingbird moth. Hummingbird moth, bee fly, mole cricket. I love convergent evolution, when unrelated animals develop the same adaptation. This is why you can gaze at a squid and it can gaze back. A detective could mistake your fingerprint for a koala's. You could thumb wrestle an opossum. Why dolphins and shrews and bats can all see sounds. Why this little moth, hardly a cousin to the vertebrate hummingbird, has developed some similar things. Wings, body shape, hovering, nectar feeding, even a sort of warm-bloodedness. The truth is that nature, both ingenious and ignorant, has her epiphanies over and over again. But convergent evolution can also make life seem less like a happy accident, as if there was a pattern, some meaning, as if we belonged here. And if you're a bit like him, and he's a bit like you, then maybe we should take care of the places that made us so similar. As I watched the 17 hummingbird moths, actually white-lined sphinx moths, forage in the bouncing bet, I had a strange sensation. I wanted to lie down in that patch of flowers and watch them from below, pretend they had risen out of me, be the earth that created such things, these insects that flew like a bird, that flew like I never could have imagined.
Jill Sisson-Quinn is a nature writer and teacher in central Wisconsin.
Not sure how many more moths we're going to see as we speak. It is snowing outside.
It's gotten a lot of different reactions from people walking by the windows here in Vilas Hall. Some happy, some less so.
We'll just leave it there, shall
yeah.
we? Well, Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find more information at www.wisconsinlife.org.
40% of new marriages involve at least one partner who's been to the altar before.
But people who are getting married for the second time face different challenges than young newlyweds. Our guest relationship expert has written a book of strategies to help people getting remarried to get past some of the hurdles.
We want to hear from you. Have you been married more than once? Are you a step-parent, or a step-grandparent? What unique challenges do you face in putting together a new family? Do you have a question or problem in your remarriage? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. Maggie Scarf joins us now. She's a fellow of Jonathan Edwards College at Yale University. She's also the author of The Remarriage Blueprint, How Remarried Couples and Their Families Succeed or Fail. Maggie, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
So why is getting remarried so much different than a first marriage?
Well, I think in America, we've had the delusion that you pop in a new parent and you so-called blend, and somehow it seems like, oh, now the family's complete. There's a new parent where there was a parent who deserted or who was abusive or where the marriage didn't work out. I should add that 95% of remarriages follow upon divorce, whereas in the last century, they followed upon death. So now we have a new situation where there is another spouse who is a member of the family, yet not in the family, so it's in the new family.
We'll dig into some of those details a little more, but in a nutshell, it's kind of bad news. There's a higher failure rate, right, for remarriages than for first marriages.
There's a significantly higher failure rate, and it comes from two sources. One is the really romantic expectations. I love you. You love me, our children will love each other. Well, we two may have fallen in love, but our children didn't have any part of any choice. They came along for the ride, and they may really have resentful feelings, or they may feel a loyalty bind, you know, the kind of thing where if I love my new step-parent, am I betraying my real parent? So there are challenges, and I've outlined five major challenges that the new family will face. But in a nutshell, it has to do with foolish expectations that everything is going to, that what was broken is going to be healed immediately. It's all going to be great, like sticking a Ken doll into the set where the Ken doll was missing or the Barbie was missing. So that's the first mistake.
I want you to tell a story, if you will. Your second chapter, a lot of your book is case studies of people you followed over a decade in some cases, including the Albrights, and you titled their chapter "The Myth of Instant Love." How did that expectation of that instant loving family, where everything was just going to merge perfectly, how did that shake out for them?
Well, that shook out badly, as you know. And that marriage lasted 18 years. And when I interviewed them, they divorced after 18 years. And when I re-interviewed them, each of them said, I truly love the other partner. But the problem was his son, whom she didn't love on sight. Now, that's a little unrealistic. You have to get to know somebody to like them or to love them. You're just not going to. What he said was, I loved her. She loved me. I just thought we would be the happiest family from day one. She would love my son, who was 7 at the time. And even after they were divorced and his son was grown and gone from the family, she said, we could never, ever reunite because of this particular son, because he was enraged. He felt blindsided by the fact that his wife didn't love this child on sight. It was so unrealistic. And that's what I mean by unrealistic expectations.
So what's they're not alone. Clearly, this is not a situation that's unique to them. What is a better way to start that? So you've got a parent, one parent with a kid marrying another parent, say, without a kid. What's a better way to have realistic expectations and then to gradually move together instead of hoping for instant love?
Well, some of the best couples that I interviewed, and I interviewed couples who had really happy remarriages, were people who understood, who moved slowly, who didn't want to jump all over the new child, the stepchild, who would do things together, play Candyland or go to a game or do various things. The best advice that a new step family or a step family in trouble can have is the following. Do not try to be together all the time. Don't try to be one big not so happy family. What you should really do is focus on one-on-one relations. The step-parent should not suddenly abandon his kid for his new love and be paying constant attention to his new love. He should make time to stay connected to his child, so it should be compartmentalizing. The same thing should happen with the step-parent. Say it's a mom, a step-parent mom. She should, if she has a stepdaughter, she should take her out shopping. She should go to the movies with her. She should do things, do homework, do games, do things, but not under the supervision of the biological parent. And for Julie Albright, what happened was he was watching every move she made. And he was criticizing every move she made. And the ex-wife was in collusion with him about the parenting, and they were criticizing her from day one. Now, here was a savvy businesswoman who ran her own business, but when it came to being a step-parent, she was just out to sea. She did not know how to defend herself and say, whoa, if I can't have any rules here, not that she would be the punisher, but that she would the family would have rules, and that she would, if he left town, which he did often, he would say, now Julie's in charge, and so on, and Julie would just sort of be like a babysitter or a monitor, but she wouldn't do the punishing. No, anything she did was wrong, and they were totally, totally at odds, though they loved each other.
We're talking to Maggie Scarf. She's author of The Remarriage Blueprint, How Remarried Couples and Their Families Succeed or Fail.
And we'd like to hear from you. Have you been married more than once? Are you a step-parent or a step-grandparent? And what challenges have you faced in blending your new family? Call in and ask our expert. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
We'll pick up our conversation now with Maggie Scarf. Her new book is The Remarriage Blueprint, How Remarried Couples and Their Families Succeed or Fail.
And we're welcoming your calls right now. Have you been married more than once? And are you facing a situation where you're combining two families? What do you want to know from our expert? You can call in and ask now at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can always post on our Facebook page.
We'll get to the phones in just a moment. But first, Maggie, I wanted to ask about money. You point out that that's a big roadblock that couples don't talk about enough at the outset.
Yeah, no, money is like the M word. They may talk about their sexual histories. They may tell the stories of their last marriage from beginning to end. But the question of money people seem to be very, very shy and wary of, because they're just worried that the other person will think they're greedy or after their money. And so money is courting couples who are about to remarry rarely discuss money. And money is a subject that should be discussed. Can you imagine being at a romantic dinner with your beloved and just having a wonderful time and saying, darling, could I see your spreadsheet? I mean,
well, maybe that's not the time, but...
But I do suggest in my book various ways that you can introduce the subject that would be non-toxic. But there's one thing that I should say before we sign off, and that is unrealistic expectations is one thing, but another thing that's really important is interpersonal skills. That is, instead of, say your stepchild runs in, kisses your husband, acts like you're a piece of furniture, pays no attention to you, just ignores you, and you start to fume. You could react to it two ways. You might say, your bratty daughter ran in here and ignored me once again. You're being such a wimp. Why don't you stand up for me? That would be the wrong way to go. The other way would be, you know, honey, I feel hurt when your daughter comes in and she ignores me. Could you ask her to look at me, make eye contact, and just say hello, so I'll know she knows I'm here, because otherwise it makes me really feel invisible. That would lead to a discussion, not to a fight.
Gotcha. We're going to go to our callers now. We've got full lines, actually. We've got Connie with us in Spooner. Connie, hi. You're on the air.
Good. Thank you.
What did you want to bring up, Connie?
I wanted to talk about stepchildren and especially something that we never considered. I got my stepdaughter when she was 4, and she is honestly just like my other children that came later, as far as, except I didn't have her from my womb. But I hear parents all the time introduce, like when they have a blended family, this is my daughter, Sarah. This is my son, Stephen. Well, and this is my stepdaughter, Christy. You know, and then not just that, but you talked about money. My stepdaughter came from her other family didn't have much. And when we would send our daughter home, she always had brand new full wardrobe, shoes, boots, coats, you know, anything that she needed or wanted, and more, because we were overindulgent. But we never thought about the 2 kids that were home that weren't going to get anything.
All right, Connie, a lot to talk about there. But let's key in on that. Do you introduce your daughter, your son, and your stepdaughter? Or do you just include them all under one umbrella, Maggie, do you think?
I think it's just whatever feels comfortable to the person. Whatever feels right to both the stepchild and the stepparent. You know, you can't make a blanket case for something like this. It's going to be on a case-by-case basis.
Maybe a kid would prefer stepdaughter in some cases.
Yeah, maybe the kid would prefer stepdaughter, and maybe the kid would feel offended because she would think her other family was being insulted. You know, it's just going to depend on, you know, a complexity, a number of complexities that are always going to attend a remarriage. And so you don't know whether the other parent's on the scene, is the other parent not on the scene, all kinds of things. But if the stepchild feels it's a pretense that's being made, that wouldn't be good. But if the stepchild feels, oh, yeah, I feel just like a sib in this family, then that's fine. But you can't make a blanket rule about something like that.
All right. Thanks, Connie. We've got Marilyn in Eau Claire now. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi.
What did you want to bring
up?
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that I am remarried. I have been remarried for about 6 years. We made a decision at the time that we got married to only include our children at the ceremony. So the preacher was there, the five adult children, and my husband and I. One of the children was married at the time. Well, two of them were, and those particular men were just kind of off to the side. So we joined hands and had that ceremony because we felt we were blending as a family, and that's how we did it. I think they really appreciated that we made that connection, and now our children are being able to be friends with each other.
All right. And thanks, Marilyn, for telling your story. What do you think? Including everybody kind of in the inner circle right from the start, Maggie.
Well, it just depends on she's talking about adult children. Adult children are already off on lives of their own, and, you know, you can have adult children that are going to, where it's going to work out just fine, and adult children where it's not going to work out fine. And I have seen both kinds of instances. Now, including them in the ceremony is just one part of it. The most important thing is making sure that each sibling and each parent stay connected. And for that, I would say, spend a lot of time compartmentalizing, making sure that you do a lot of one-on-ones. And that is the best overall advice you can give. I think you can cite instances that are totally different, that don't work, that are simply not relevant to this, to a generality. But the general rule is spend plenty of one-on-one time, and you will keep those relationships vibrant, emotionally connected, and really working. And if that was a good start and it turned out to continue to be a good start, fine. But the family that tries to do everything together all the time is not such a smart idea.
All right, Maggie, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. That was Maggie Scarf. Her book is The Remarriage Blueprint, How Remarried Couples and Their Families Succeed or Fail.
You can keep the conversation about second marriages and step-parenting going on the Central Time Facebook page. You can find us by searching Central Time on WPR.
Coming up next, our guest is worried about glitches in the Affordable Care Act's website. He says it's a sign of things to come. This is Central Time.